Chapter 12, Buenos Aires.
Tell me how you made the transition from radio to television.
I can't remember really doing any television before I went to South America. The transition from radio to television wasn't really an easy one. I was one of the very, very few of the radio news people who did manage to make the transition. And it all happened in a peculiar way. When NBC decided to have me on their payroll rather than the local payroll, I suddenly, overnight, became the NBC West Coast correspondent. As television developed, there was a need for a story every now and then. Dave Garraway's Today Show wanted an interview with somebody important out here. One of them was Dear Abby, Pauline, I forget her last name. She's now dead, and the daughter's writing the column. Also, Hank Ketchum, who does the Dennis comic strip.
Dennis the Menace.
Dennis the Menace. And the way these interviews were handled was that I would be not on camera, but the person I'm talking to is on camera with a tight headshot. And I would ask a question, and they would reply, and I would keep my mouth shut so that I didn't infringe on anything they were saying. And the interview was eventually used with Dave Garraway asking the question that I asked. And I got a comic book from Ketchum after we did this thing. And they were to call me Dave if they were going to personalize this thing. And I got a comic book that was inscribed by Ketchum saying, "Hey, hi, Uncle Ed, or is it Uncle Dave?" Something to that effect. Anyhow, I really wanted to be a foreign correspondent. And the people I was dealing with, John Thompson, my immediate boss, didn't see eye to eye with me on that. And I couldn't make any headway with the brass in New York. So I concocted the plan that I would make them the offer they couldn't refuse. I offered to go anywhere in the world as an NBC stringer with no compensation, but with the full title of correspondent, a year's take time off from my duties in San Francisco. And I could then see what would happen at the conclusion of the year. I'd figured out that with the volunteer stuff I was doing for Monitor and for Ring Around the World, which was an analysis thing that they broadcast on weekends, I had a pretty good in with the radio guys in New York. I figured that with the fees that they would have to pay me for the stuff that they broadcast, I could earn between $9,000 and $14,000 over a year out of the fees, which was enough to sustain me and the family there while I got whatever else that came my way. But I was to be the NBC correspondent in Buenos Aires, with full accreditation. NBC was getting a bargain. It cost them nothing but what they had to pay when they used my material.
So you were going to take a leave of absence? And
it was a leave of absence. I got it in writing because it was necessary at the end, as it turned out.
Because you didn't know if you'd have a job when you came back?
Well, I wanted to be sure I had a job when I came back, so I covered my tracks.
So you just made sure it was a leave of absence and that you would be coming back to your old job.
On my assignment to Buenos Aires, the vice president of NBC News, Elmer Lauer, wrote a letter to me spelling out the terms of our agreement, which included my taking a leave of absence for a year and could return to my job if they had nothing else to offer me. And that's the way it worked out. Well, basically, I was as green as you can be with television in Buenos Aires. I had to learn, and I had to learn from cameramen, how this all was done. And part of the chores were 60-second stand-ups of analysis of a situation that you were in. And because all of us had trouble memorizing a whole minute's worth of material, we would do it in takes, and it also would be so that they could change the shot. And the way it was done, you'd talk for 15 seconds, face on the camera, and then the camera would be turned off. You turn your head the other way, and you repeat the last sentence while the camera is rolling as you turn back toward the camera. It was very classy.
Very clever.
I lost it up a few times, but I got on the air, Huntley Brinkley and the Today Show with some of these pieces. And little by little, I learned the game of television. I had a good cameraman in Buenos Aires. I had a better cameraman in Rio. And it all worked out.
So you made this pretty daring proposal. I mean, it sounds like you thought it through, but I mean, it was, like you said, a proposal.
A big gamble.
It was a big gamble for you, not having a guaranteed income, but, you know, you had sort of figured out that you could make these fees and make it work. And I can see how it would be a proposal that they, an offer they couldn't refuse. And so did they jump at it? Did they have to think about it?
There wasn't much thought.
They just said, that sounds great, let's go with it.
When I'm sure they discussed it in the news department at the time. And they decided, okay, if this is what he wants to do, how about Buenos Aires? And then they discussed where. And Buenos Aires was their choice, not mine.
How much time between the time you made the proposal and the time we packed for Buenos Aires was there?
I don't recall exactly, but it was probably something like 4 or 5 months.
Oh, okay.
Because we had to ship steamer trunk down with all the invaluable possessions we had that we couldn't get there. I made a number of good decisions.
I vaguely remember soy sauce being in there, but
soy sauce. Horseradish was the toughest thing to get down there, and the crab was so good, we wanted horseradish with it. I finally found it in a specialty store for the English clientele.
So you had to make all the arrangements to get us moved down there yourself.
Mm-hmm. Including the air. I paid.
Wow. You paid.
Yeah, but it was cheap in those days.
So tell a little bit about what it was like getting set up in Buenos Aires. Who helped you? Because it had to be difficult.
We were tremendously helped, these people turned out to be invaluable. The Spindlers. When I knew I was going to Buenos Aires, I did a little research around San Francisco for some Argentines, and ran across this woman who was the wife of a doctor who was a terror on wheels, but a nice person otherwise. And her parents lived in Buenos Aires, and she set it up for me to see them, and they were all set up to know what I needed. And it was the Spindlers who found that apartment and negotiated that apartment at a very reasonable rate. It turned out that the landlord there was very angry with the Spindlers because he didn't know it wasn't for them, that it was for me. For an American, he would have asked much more money. And in many ways, they opened the door for me to a lot of good contacts, and it worked out very, very well because of them.
What kind of stories did you start covering when you first got down there?
Well, Ken Bernstein was the NBC correspondent who was vacating the post or had vacated the post some 6 months earlier. NBC had Buenos Aires as a bureau up until about 6 months before I went down there. Ken was moved to Paris, and I corresponded with Ken a great deal about how to operate the bureau down there. And it was Ken who told me, you're going to have a tough time selling anything but three stories: revolution, disaster, and anti-Semitism. He said, New York will buy that a lot faster than anything, even if it seems like it's consequential from where you're sitting down there. It would be very difficult to sell anything that wasn't instant or inflammatory. That was part of the way I faced my figuring out what kind of stories I could sell and how I could sell them and to what shows. Because I was now dealing with a multitude of shows on NBC that I was trying to sell material to. I had full cable privileges. NBC did give me that, so that I had means of immediate contact with New York to sell them stuff or to pitch them on stuff that they might want, or to suggest something that was going on somewhere else that I might cover. And they flew me all over the place covering stuff. I flew to Peru, I flew to Chile, I flew to Bolivia, I flew to Brazil. These are all individual flights on stories. Because of my being an accredited correspondent with all the credentials, the government of Argentina at the Pink House, Casa Rosada, gave me full accreditation, which in turn gave me 50% off on all flights on Aerolíneas Argentinas.
Oh, wow.
All the time I was down there, and for a little while thereafter, I flew Aerolíneas Argentinas at half price, at whatever ticket I wanted to buy.
So you were footing the bill on all your airfare when you were covering stories?
I was expensed on anything they assigned. Anything I wanted to do on my own.
But if it was for a story, they picked up the tab.
Right.
So what kind of stories were you covering? Because you were going all over. You said you went to Chile. You went to La Paz. I remember going to La Paz.
We went to
Uruguay, Paraguay. I mean, what were some of the stories that you were covering in those places?
Well, I was doing mainly monitor material, offbeat stuff. In La Paz, I had arranged to do a thing on hunting crocodiles. And I made friends with some sportsmen up there, and we arranged for them to take me on a crocodile shoot up the Chaco. They had a jeep, and we went up the Chaco for them to try and shoot alligators at night with lights that blinded them. So they came to the surface, and I was there with camera to take pictures. I was shooting them, not the crocodiles. Well, a little of both, but with a camera. And we came back from that story in pretty good spirits, and they hit a horse, an old nag, on the dirt road, which completely demolished the jeep as well as the horse. I can't remember how I got back to La Paz, but that was one of the more interesting stories. Oh, there were so many of them, though. You know, when I was doing stories for KPIX, I used to keep a daily log of what stories I did that day, because the next day I couldn't remember what I did the last day. I had to keep a log in order to be able to bill for the excess fees that were involved in virtually everything that was done on the air.
I remember a story you wrote about in the memoir about some miners and American hostages.
Yeah. That story was a big, important story in the States. Four Americans with the State Department in Bolivia, serving in various capacities, nobody really high level. But they were serving the State Department in Bolivia, and they were taken hostage at the tin mines near Oruro. A group of us correspondents were sent by our various organizations immediately to La Paz, Bolivia, to get what we could. This was a pretty good running story. We managed to get to the tin mines within a matter of a few days. The time when, in chartering the Bolivian airline, Bolivian military airliner, to take us out of La Paz to a point where we could get closest to the mine, and we paid, I don't know, something like $200 or $400 for this flight. Everything was cheap in those days. I was the bag man. I got the money from the bank, paid in cash, and the Bolivian currency was worth so little then. The largest note that they had was worth 8 cents. So I had a big attaché, a case full of money to pay off the airplane ride.
Yeah.
And we were there while the hostages were being held by Bolivian women who were in their shanty peasant outfits, not looking very good from wear and tear. And they had dynamite caps stuffed in their stockings. And these were the people holding the captives with dynamite caps.
Why were they being held hostage? Because of working conditions?
It had to do with a strike that was going on. It had very little to do with the United States. It was a splash that they could make to hold the vice president accountable for their situations. These were people who were simply captured. And we were there, the whole group of us, some 8 correspondents, for almost a week. I got to know some interesting people. We had dinner every night with the bishop. The religion was in full force, the Catholic religion, and everybody praying for the safety of not only the hostages, but the miners, because they didn't know what the military government might do. We had access to the room where the hostages were held. Couldn't take any pictures in there, but I was permitted to go in and talk to them. I did some recording with them. That was only on one or two occasions. They weren't all that loose. The whole situation came to an anticlimactic end. We got word that there was some arguments going on within the group that were holding the hostages. Word travels fast in a small little mining community. It really is it's a small operation. There was talk about them being possibly released that day. I wanted to get that photographed. So I positioned myself across from the door to the shed where they were in, just across a dirt path. It was a stakeout. I stayed there for almost 8 hours because the rumors kept circulating back and forth about imminent release and arguments and whatnot. Finally, out of nowhere, the four of them wandered out of the door. Apparently, the hostage holders had gone off into another room to argue, and they just simply walked out, and I photographed it, and it was used. That was the end of that's what brought me home Christmas Eve.
Oh, God, that's great.
Home to Montevideo. During that summer, which is
winter.
Christmas,
yeah.
during that summer, our friends, the Lancasters, Addie and Joe Lancaster, were in Montevideo. He was the director of the American college there. And Joanna and Addie were good friends, and Joe and I were good friends. And they enticed Joanna to come on over to Buenos Aires for the summer, which was fine with me. I kept coming back and forth from there on weekends. It's not that big a trip. When they found a place, a house very close to where their home was, at a ridiculously low price, we jumped on it, and that's how you spent the summer and Christmas in Montevideo.
Yeah, I remember getting the Christmas tree. You found a Christmas tree. They didn't celebrate Christmas down there.
Yeah, they celebrate Christmas, but not with trees.
Right.
The American community there, which was not very large, had access to trees of one sort or another, and by the time I got there on Christmas Eve, there was not a tree to be purchased anywhere. But I found a scrawny old, terrible-looking thing that somebody had discarded. I needed to have a stand to put it on, and there was a construction project going on two doors down from where we were living, and they had some cement. I mixed some cement and put it into a paint can and stood there long enough for it to settle and then brought it home, and that was our Christmas tree. And you guys all made wonderful ornaments. You were in on the plot and knew you had lots of time to get it done.
Do you have a favorite interview you did while you were in South America?
One of the stories that I did for television, and one of the most interesting stories I did, was to interview the son of Adolf Eichmann on the anniversary of his assassination. Adolf Eichmann was assassinated, was executed in Israel. They had captured him in Buenos Aires and had transported him back. And that, of course, was a major story several years before. But after the execution, I went out to a village about 10 or 12 miles outside of town with my trusty secretary.
Oh, Maria.
Maria was my absolutely indispensable arm. She spoke excellent English. She spoke German. And, of course, she was a native of Argentina. She also spoke Hungarian.
That's what I thought.
She spoke a number of languages, and that was great. She would go over the morning papers, all the morning papers in Buenos Aires, and to look for anything that I might find interesting and translate them for me, if I couldn't get the full translation, or would follow up with the telephone and get information for me, and was very good at handling it. Well, Maria and I, and cameraman, went out to this shack where this son of Eichmann appeared outside. He was a kid in his early 20s. The shack that he came out of was dirt floor. It was a hut where he and his wife lived. And he came out and did an interview with me, with Maria translating. So we were operating in two languages. This was a television piece that was both in English and German. They talked German. And big success, that interview, inside the shack, which he permitted me to go in, but couldn't take the camera in. It was adorned with Nazi paraphernalia. He appeared in a Nazi uniform for this interview.
So he was in complete support of his father.
Oh, yes. Total defense of his father. That's what it was. This is the son defending his father.
Wow.
And we used the pieces of it that made sense and shipped it on off to New York. There was another incident which was not related to television that really was touching. When Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, I had gone to an afternoon matinee movie with Joanna. We came out of the movie and sat down at a sidewalk cafe on Nueve de Julio, the big wide street. We were sipping coffee and having croissants or something. And the waiter there, who knew me, came over to me and said, "Your president's been killed." I said, "What?" He said, "Yes, it's all over the news." I said, you must be thinking of the father of the president. He's an old man." I got up and went to the phone, their phone at the bar, the cafe, called the AP in Buenos Aires, all of whom, all the news agencies, we were all pals. And they said, "Yeah, it's true. He was shot to death in Dallas. Johnson's the president." I came back to the table and we got up immediately. I had the Buenos Aires Herald under my arm, which is the English language paper in Buenos Aires. And we got on the subway to return to our apartment. And this was a period of time when there was a lot of tension between America and Argentina. Had a lot to do with the oil contracts. And just anti-Americanism was riding pretty high at the time. And when we got on the subway car, because of the Herald under my arm, people immediately took us for Americans correctly. And virtually everybody in the subway car came over to me to express condolences for the death of my president. Mm. The next day, when I went down to the embassy to see what was going on, there was a Marine at the front door, but the door was open. And there was virtually no way you could get into the building because of all the flowers, the bouquets, the arrangements covered the entire floor, entry, little vestibule where the elevator was as an expression of, from the Argentine people over their grief for the loss of Kennedy, who still was a hero because this was America's first Catholic president. It was Kennedy who started the Alianza para el Progreso.
What was that?
The Alliance for Progress.
With
all of South America.
Wow. Well, that is touching. Do you want to talk about the Chilean presidential election?
During my stay in Rio, I ended up, after living in luxury in Wilson Hall's old flat, and had to find a place for myself when Wilson was permanently assigned elsewhere. I had to close down the flat, and I found an apartment with an elevator. Very nice apartment. It was unfurnished, however. Kitchen was operable. I got a bed somewhere or a mattress somewhere and put it in. And it was during this period when I went to the consulate party. I forget what the occasion was. It may have been the 4th of July, but that probably was it because the timing seems to be about right. During this party, I met a young, just out of Stanford Law School graduate who had come to South America with Nader's Raiders. This was before Nader had become a big-time hotshot. This young man, Jeff Bingaman, was on the shorts. He was in Rio with not a lot of money, and I told him he could come bunk with me, and he did. So after Jeff came in and lived with me, I got assigned to cover a story in Santiago, and Jeff came along. Jeff Bingaman, who is the current United States Senator from New Mexico, Jeff and I were in Santiago for several days. We covered Allende very closely. I spent a full day just tracking him with a camera. We were the only ones doing it. He was out on the campaign stump, and we rode around in his train, going from place to place, with me shooting a lot of film and doing a lot of reporting on what was to be a very important election in Chile. Jeff was invaluable in that, and getting to meet Allende for me was wonderful. Well, Allende didn't win that election. Eduardo Frei won the election, and it was all very peaceful and all very legitimate. Allende went on to become the president later at another election. I never ceased to remark at how quiet and peaceful Chile was at that time. The president lived in quarters that was some four blocks from the official. His residence was four blocks from the official offices of the government. And he would walk those four blocks with no one accompanying him, no security, and would talk to people who would come out and talk to him on his route to the office. A remarkable sight.
Wow. Couldn't see that nowadays, I bet.
I don't think you'd see that nowadays anywhere in the world.
You stayed in Argentina after we left.
You left Argentina because Joanna had to have a cataract operation on her eyes. The decision was made that she would return to San Francisco for that, and we arranged for you and Stephanie to stay with your sister in New York.
Your sister, Sylvia.
My sister, Sylvia. I was in Rio on my own.
Finishing up doing stories and...
Well, I was there until my assignment there ended, until my leave of absence had ended, and the question of whether I was going to stay there, going to be reassigned somewhere else. I was reassigned to Miami. When your mother's eye operation was completed, you and Stephanie went to San Francisco from New York. And the three of you, after the operation, came to Miami on a train. You crossed the country on a train.
All right, I remember that.
And I, by this time, had negotiated a home in Miami Beach. It was pretty well set up for your arrival when you got there. You got there ahead of me, I think, and ended up in a motel. I'm trying to reconstruct this. It's really immaterial how it all happened, but what happened was we went out on Collins Avenue. I had to do a report. It was the one bad mistake I made with time. I became such an efficient judge of what time it was where in the world. And I had arrangements with NBC Monitor to do an analysis piece live from Miami. And I botched the time because I didn't figure that Miami hadn't gone on daylight time and there was now a four-hour difference in my mentality. Anyhow, I checked in an hour late and everybody was screaming at me from New York, and rightfully so, but I was in a phone booth on Collins Avenue in Miami. And I did my report from that phone booth, and all was well there. And on our way out of there, my toe started hurting, and I couldn't remember, where did I stub it? Later that night at the motel, I was in bed with this terribly sore toe. The pain was so intense, I literally couldn't put a sheet over it. And I said, I've got a broken toe. I've got to get to the hospital. And Joanna said to me, you bum, you got the gout. You got the gout, you bum, laughing. Well, she was exactly right. The pain, I couldn't believe it. The pain was so bad. But they got me to a hospital, and indeed, it was gout. And I have been on medication for gout the rest of my life. I've never had an attack that bad. But some of them can be pretty bad. Ask anyone who has gout, they'll tell you.
This concludes Chapter 12.